I Am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. A book I found fascinating to read and difficult to put down is Broadway to Main Street, How Show Tunes Enchanted America. It's a terrific sketch of how popular music was influenced by the music of the American musical theater, and how from New York's theater district they made their way to living rooms across the United States. Thanks to the albums of original cast recordings, covers by popular vocalists of the era through to television appearances in the middle to late 20th century, show music became tremendously popular and ubiquitous. It competed against the popular music of the era, be it Elvis or later the Beatles. And even today it remains popular thanks to Glee, as well as the popularity of cast recordings of shows like The Book of Mormon, Hamilton, and Dear Evan Hansen. The book features new interviews with Stephen Schwartz, Harold Prince, Sheldon Harnick, and Steve Lawrence, as well as a surfeit of prominent record producers and critics. Lawrence Maslin is the book's author, and he joins me now. I'll get him to reflect on how Broadway has underscored a lot of American life, as well as how it's had impact on show business writ large and American culture. Lawrence Maslin is an arts professor and associate chair of the graduate acting program at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts. He is the author of several books on the theater, including the companion volume to the PBS series Broadway, the American Musical with Michael Cantor. As well, he edited the Library of America's two-volume set, American Musicals, 1927 to 1969. He is also the host and producer of the weekly radio program and podcast Broadway to Main Street. It's a good show in which a lot of music referenced in the book is played. This new book is published by Oxford University Press. Please welcome to the Plant on the Land program in New York City, Lawrence Maslin. Professor Maslin, good morning.
Hey, nice to speak to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. So how different is it, the relationship that say, Broadway music has to, say, mainstream popular music, say 150 years ago with operettas and things like that?
Well, 150 years ago, there really wasn't Broadway music because there really wasn't a Broadway in the way that we understand it. So about 1904 with George M. Cohan, and give my regards to Broadway in the beginning of the theater district. But very quickly after that, music is from Broadway as a sort of cultural mecca managed to get its way all across America and all across the world.
So, but before that, though, did popular music, say, reflect, say, the operas that people were listening to or things like that?
More like Stephen Foster music, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Every family that had, you know, two nickels to rub together, the first thing they would buy was a piano. So maybe they'd have classical music, maybe they'd have music by Franz Lehár or Johann Strauss, something like that.
Yeah. So
but Broadway, yeah. Broadway is a Broadway show tune as we know it, really didn't come about until about, you know, 19-teens.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems that even now, 100 years later, you write in the book just how relevant it is in terms of, say the popularity of things like Hamilton, obviously. The Book of Mormon sold very well as a cast recording, and Dear Evan Hansen. Mm-hmm. Still does well. Does that surprise you that it's remained, I don't know if relevance is the right word, but it's certainly been robust over the last 100 years or so?
That it's been robust over the last 100 years or recently?
That it continues to be robust, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, it's had times where robust is not a word I would use, you know, if I had 382 other words to use, but it's become seminal again for two reasons, I think. Hamilton is a huge hit. It really transcended all boundaries and all sort of cultural markers, and that is how change happens usually, with something that floats all boats. And secondly is technology, which is something I write a lot about in the book, is the notion of trying to transform a live theatrical experience into something that can be enjoyed at home or while you're jogging or while you're shopping or whatever is complicated. And I think streaming and people being able to do their own playlists and make their own selections, they're sort of doing what music publishers did, you know, 70 years ago. So technology allows greater access to these this kind of music.
And I guess the LP, the record, the album, I mean, that really sort of made it mainstream, didn't it?
Well, the LP, you know, which was, what, a total of maybe 52 minutes, 27, 25 minutes on each side. One of the miraculous things is the technical creation of that in 1948 absolutely paralleled the creation of the narrative musical as we know it by Rodgers and Hammerstein. So now there was a format where you might want to hear all of the story of the South Pacific, or if you listen to 13 songs from South Pacific, they told a story for the first time. So you only had to get up once and flip it over, as opposed to the old days of the 78s, where you had to get up every 3.5 minutes to change the record.
And so was South Pacific the first time that, say, even before the cast recording came out, that popular vocalists of the day would, say, cover the songs on other albums, other records?
Oh, gosh, no. That happened, you know, in the 20s. It happened way back. I mean, the people who recorded music from Broadway shows for many years weren't necessarily the people who were in them. Mm-hmm. George M. Cohan, who was the greatest songwriter between, I don't know, 1904 and 1918, he only made 10 records in his whole existence. And a lot of his hit songs were covered by a variety of singers who could sing well into the gramophone. It was more of a technical challenge than a performance accuracy. And this whole notion we have of, gee, you know, it's got to be Ethel Merman from Anything Goes, and she never recorded anything from Anything Goes because no one was interested in a cast recording of Anything Goes back in 1934. So other pop stars of the era sang them.
So you write in the book that people like Rudy Vallee, Bing Crosby, were some of those singers, some of those vocalists. But Sinatra, he would have been, as you write in the book, the greatest ambassador for the music of Broadway, even though he had never appeared on Broadway, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. I mean, he never dared to do the 8 shows a week on Broadway, but not only did he record so much, I mean, he started recording Cole Porter and Oscar Hammerstein in the late 1930s. He was recording songs by Stephen Sondheim and Cy Coleman into the early 1980s. Mm. And he always, in addition to, you know, the rampant popularity of Sinatra, I give him a lot of credit because certainly in concert and often on the radio, he would tell you about these songwriters. He would tell you who they were and what their craftsmanship was like and why the average listener should know about them and respect them. And I think he went that extra mile to honor the creators of the Broadway songbook.
Even if it was inaccurate, like I'm thinking of the Send in the Clowns recording, the in-studio recording that he made, I guess the first one he made, where he actually narrates before the song, the context of the song. And it's not really what happens in A Little Night Music, but it gives the point,
well,
I guess, you know.
I think the point he's saying is maybe the average listener shouldn't care so much about the plot of A Little Night Music. They might feel bad they couldn't go to New York and see this musical set in Sweden. He was just saying, look, just listen to the song. It's really great, and it'll touch you if you've ever had any heartbreak in your life. Who wouldn't be touched by that?
Now, as someone who's looked at the history of show tunes, as you do in this book, a cast recording, when it was, say, originally conceived of, was it for the audience that saw the show and wanted to take it home, say, or what was it to say, encourage people in middle America to want to get to New York and see a show?
I think the short answer is, you know, D, all of the above. Mm-hmm. I think it met the American public in many, many different ways. I'm sure there are millions of people in North America who heard The Music Man or Sound of Music or Kiss Me, Kate, and never thought they would ever see it or could ever see it, but in their head an amazing show played at home in the living room. And then there are people who saw it and wanted to remember it. So it works in all sorts of capacities. And as I say, that challenge of how do you wrap your arms around a huge 2.5-hour Broadway show with sets and costumes and choreography and a star performance and distill it to something that someone sitting at home in Victoria or Vancouver in their living room can enjoy.
Did its ubiquity in people's homes, did that shape musical tastes or say just give them another kind of genre of music, say, that people could enjoy?
That's a good question. I think certainly the fact that it came from Broadway, that it came from New York, that it came from the Gershwins or Cole Porter or Rodgers and Hammerstein gave it a sort of high shelf ambassadorship to most homes. I think that, you know, certainly when you get to the 50s, but even in the 30s and 40s, you had a lot of junky music, Spike Jones and stuff like that maybe. But somehow to bring a Broadway album or a song written by these great composers into your home, no one would contest that. You know, that was just a one shelf down from Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms.
Yeah, and like I, when I go to garage sales or flea markets nowadays, I always see in the record box the original cast recording of My Fair Lady. Was that the, everyone had that, right?
Well, I mean, quote-unquote, everyone had it. It was certainly on the charts for almost a decade, and it was talked about, again, on the Ed Sullivan Show, or on your local disc jockey might play it, or your aunt came back from New York and bought it. So it was something I think your people with middle-class aspirations or consumer aspirations had to have.
And the cover of your book features Julie Andrews. I guess that's from the recording of that album,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, the morning she recorded it.
Yeah. Ed Sullivan's role in promoting musicals, you write about that in the book. You had the opportunity, I guess, over the course of writing the book to see a lot of these clips. We forget now just how big the Ed Sullivan Show was on Sunday nights, not only across America, but, you know, even in this country they were watching it.
Sure.
That really brought the musical, the visual aspect of it to people's homes, didn't it?
I think it did. I mean, Ed used to be a Broadway columnist in the 20s and 30s, so he came by it honestly. He adored Broadway, and he really kind of genuflected at the altar of the great composers. He loved them. So not only would he bring 15, 20 minutes of a Broadway show, because his show was Sunday night, when back then most Broadway shows were dark, so everyone was free to come over to the studio without canceling a performance. Mm-hmm. He also talked a lot about Broadway, and he would bring Oscar Hammerstein or Richard Rodgers on stage and, like Sinatra did, introduce them to America and give them a sense of how important they were and maybe little glimpses into how they worked even. It's sort of, if you would say, oh, gee, Jimmy Kimmel is going to give 20 minutes over to Lin-Manuel Miranda and talk to him about how he puts the Hamilton together, not impossible, but anybody else, it would be impossible now in the 21st century to imagine how much time and attention that these Broadway giants were given by Ed Sullivan. And it wasn't just Ed Sullivan. Every variety show, the Kraft Variety Hour or whatever, Dinah Shore Show, they would always have people from Broadway.
And a lot of those clips survive, don't they? I mean, we see them on public television sometimes.
Yeah, you don't get to see the crown jewels though, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I had to go to the Library of Congress and see all of them, but that wasn't so bad for me. It's just licensing is very difficult, because if you have a show from 1963 with 40 people in it, you got to track them all down.
Yeah.
Very difficult to do.
Yeah. It must have been fun writing this book, was it?
Well, you know, I always thought the cast album and Broadway music should be given a decent break and should be. People should be reminded how popular it was. So for me, it was a chance really to go back and listen to the stuff I'm listening to anyway every day and just do a little more research on them. So it was great, and people really seem to enjoy it, and I hope it's kind of spreading the word about how important and seminal this music was in American culture.
And what's great for the reader is they're reading the book. You have captions, I don't know if that's the right word, but there's a website at the beginning of the book, and then you can go and listen to some of these clips, right?
Yeah, they're not very long for legal reasons.
Sure.
Maybe like 20 seconds, but I also have my own radio show called Broadway to Main Street, and I did a whole hour on the book, so they're much more extended songs in that venue.
And if you've got one of those streaming services, you can certainly download a lot of these cast recordings, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, by the way, the theme song for your show.
Yes.
Is that from a show, or is that something that?
No, that's sweet that you mentioned that. The music is by Mel Marvin, who's a wonderful composer. He worked on Tintypes and Elmer Gantry, and he's a colleague of mine at NYU. And I wrote the lyrics, And David Garrison, the Tony-nominated actor, a big Broadway stalwart, singing it. So that's our own little signature number.
It's really great. I mean, it has right away when you hear that, it takes you to you know, it's wonderful in how it sets the theme of the show. I mean, it is a theme of the show, the nostalgia of it, and you're really in for a great hour when you're when that thing hits, you know.
That's great. Thank you.
So the covers of songs, Edie Gourmet's "If You Walked Into My Life," which was from MAME.
Mm-hmm.
Did that come out before the show even opened?
Yeah, it did. It was on the charts back then while the show was still in tryouts. So not only was it, people knew it, but Angel Lansbury was a little nervous having to perform it on Broadway because people liked the Edie Gourmet's version so much. But that was the big thing back then. The song Cabaret, which we all know, was performed for the first time by Louis Armstrong on the Ed Sullivan Show a month before Cabaret even went into rehearsal.
Really?
So.
Yeah, it's remarkable to think that, you know, that these shows would get a boost out of the popularity of these covers, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, and you got to talk to Steve Lawrence for this book, I understand.
He
sang to you.
Yeah, he did.
That must have been really cool.
Yeah, I mean, Sammy Davis, Stephen Eady, Bob Goulet, these are people maybe that people don't know back in their era were really popular. But they're also really excellent musicians. And one thing I write about in the book is, again, Sammy Davis Jr., Bob Goulet, Stephen Eady, they all appeared in Broadway shows. I mean, they gave up insanely lucrative contracts to be in Vegas to do 8 shows a week on Broadway, which is, not for the faint of heart. So I give them a lot of credit. And on the other hand, there are people like Sinatra and Judy Garland and Bing Crosby and Perry Como, who did a lot for Broadway music, but they weren't going to go to New York for 8 months and do that.
That's it. You mentioned Sammy Davis Jr., and I know you're well acquainted with him, having written about him previously. He performed a lot of Broadway material on records, and even on television and concert and the sort, right up to the end. Phantom of the Opera, I think, was in one concert.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The last thing he ever did, he was on a Jerry Lewis telethon out of New York, and he sang I Dreamed a Dream from Les Mis.
That's right.
And this is a kid who started in 19, a guy who started as a kid in 1925 singing, songs from the Chitlin Circuit. So Broadway did a lot for these. I mean, we sort of say, they had Louis Armstrong had a big hit with Hello Dolly, good for Louis, made a lot of money. But these songs did a lot for them. They were highly respected songs, so there was no quibble when, a Sammy Davis or a Steve Lawrence put an album out that says, Steve Lawrence sings Broadway. No one was going to question that. They might question, how much was that Doggy in the Window and other sort of novelty numbers that other people sang. But it was a real sign for consumers that this was going to be quality stuff. Even if it wasn't quality stuff, it certainly opened the door to bring that material into your home.
So we're recording this on Monday the 19th, and I understand that later tonight you'll be spending some time on a panel with others, and among the folks are, I guess, is Thomas Z. Shepherd. Is that right?
Yep.
We know him from I guess a lot of people saw him on the Company cast recording documentary.
Yep.
He's someone, and you write about him and Goddard Liebertson. These were two people, when you read about their work in your book, Broadway to Main Street, really elevate the craft of how to put an album like a cast recording together, don't they?
Yeah, again, I think they were magicians in the sense that they were able to take something so visually oriented and slam it into 52 minutes on a piece of black vinyl with a hole in the middle and still make you feel you weren't missing something. And that's a big thing. I know that we tend to like the shows we grow up with. We tend to honor those. And for me, I'm an LP kid. I grew up in the 60s. So to me, 53 minutes of a show is really kind of all I need. I don't need the whole show. I don't need 85 minutes on a CD with playout music and music for the curtain call and stuff. So they thought about it in very concrete, specific terms with boundaries. and to the point where they actually thought a lot about where when you had to get up and flip the record over. Goddard Lieberson famously moved the order of songs in Camelot so that when you put on side B, the first song you heard was If Ever I Would Leave You, because he knew that would grab the listener again.
Yeah, and was there ever talk early on about, say, actually recording the show live and putting that out, say?
I think live recordings were difficult because the studio allowed you a certain amount of control. I quote a fellow named J. David Sachs, who's also a record producer, and he said, if you heard the show as it was done live, it wouldn't sound like the show live. Mm-hmm. In other words, what we do in the studio is sort of make you think, give you the illusion that you're actually sitting through the show, but, you know, that's we do very different things in the theater that we do in the recording studio to try to make it work on its own terms, which makes a lot of sense to me.
What's also fascinating in the book is you write about just the money involved and how some labels actually put up money to help bankroll the show, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Does that still happen today?
I think it will start to happen again with Hamilton. I think Atlantic Records has gotten very involved with shows. They recorded Dear Evan Hansen. I think it's the first time Atlantic has really gotten back on the board since the 70s. My Fair Lady changed everything. My Fair Lady was like printing money.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great things about cast albums also is you pay the cast once, and that's it. You don't have to do, it's not like the Beatles where you sort of have to chase them down and do retakes and stuff like that. My Fair Lady was such a gold mine that executives thought, well, gee, I mean, for a mere, and we say mere, quote unquote, you know, $200,000, I could get the exclusive rights to Camelot or the next show or whatever and make money. And of course, it's kind of a big joke. It's almost like out of the Mel Brooks producers, because you don't know if it's going to be any good, really. And you had to make a lot of shots in the dark, and a lot of publishers and producers would say, hey, you know, they'd go to Tony Bennett, Columbia, hey, Tony, we optioned this musical called Foxy. It's going to be great. It's Johnny Mercer lyrics and Robert Emmett Dolan, and here are two songs that are great for you. Why don't you record it as a 45? And he did. And the show comes to New York and lasts 3 weeks, and they're stuck with, you know, stuff they're going to have to melt down into paperweights.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting gamble.
And so we started the conversation talking about the sort of the revival that they're taking on in terms of, say, digital downloads and the sort. But Glee, the television show, that helped a lot too, didn't it?
I think, you know, Broadway was so marginalized from the mid-70s on. It's really helped. A show like Glee really helps make it, and I want to say cool, but certainly cooler. And I had the pleasure of seeing a show called The Prom that just opened on Broadway Friday night.
Uh-huh.
And I took my 10-year-old son, and I realized I was walking home. You know, we've got Mean Girls, you've got Dear Evan Hansen, and you've got The Prom. They're all set in high schools. Forget about high school-age characters. They're all set in high schools. And when I was growing up, the heroes of the musicals were middle-aged milkmen, matchmakers, and music men. You know, they
right.
were my parents were the heroes of musicals, and now the kids are the heroes and heroines of musicals, and I think that's a big, big help. I think it's a big help.
It brings them into the theaters, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it makes them feel like their stories are relevant.
Right, right. So you do have hope, don't you, that this art form will continue and thrive?
I've always had hope for it. I think Broadway is very cyclical, and I think that there's nothing like live theater. And, you know, the story of when it gets in sync and when it gets out of sync is always a fascinating one and will continue to be.
Well, I urge people to pick up this book, because if they'll read it like I did, they'll enjoy it a great deal, and then they'll turn to your podcast and enjoy that weekly. I appreciate your time. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
I will say my next book is the companion book to Come From Away, so I hope we'll have ongoing friendships with our friends up in Canada.
That thing has taken off, and it's run in Toronto, I think, but it comes to Vancouver. Yeah, it comes to Vancouver in the spring. Eastern Canada obviously likes it and adores it. I mean, it's a show that I think that Canadians will like once they see it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks for this, Lawrence.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
The book is called Broadway to Main Street, How Show Tunes Enchanted America. It's published by Oxford University Press. Its author, Lawrence Maslin, joined me on the line from New York City and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunto.